So I think at this time we're ready to kick off the session. Today's speakers are Dr. Tom Sale and Dr. Chuck Newell. Dr. Sale is the director of the Center for Contaminant Hydrology and Civil and Environmental Engineering at Colorado State University and is an independent consulting hydrogeologist. His research and consulting over the past 25 years have focused on innovative solutions for groundwater contaminants in source zones and plumes. Dr. Sale received his PhD from Colorado State University, his MS degree from the University of Arizona, and BA degrees from Miami of Ohio. His qualifications are reflected in his selection for the Environmental Protection Agency DNAPL Source Expert Panel and the National Research Council's Army-funded Committee on Source Removal of Contaminants in the Subsurface. Our other presenter today is Dr. Newell, who is the Vice President of GSI Environmental, Inc. He's a member of the American Academy of Environmental Engineers. He's also an NGWA-certified groundwater professional and an adjunct professor at Rice University. He has co-authored 3 EPA publications, 5 environmental decision support software systems, many, many technical articles, and 2 books titled Natural Attenuation of Fuels and Chlorinated Solvents, as well as Groundwater Contamination, Transport, and Remediation. His professional expertise includes site characterization, groundwater monitoring, non-aqueous phase liquids, risk assessment, natural attenuation, fire remediation, non-point source studies, software development, and long-term monitoring projects. He's also taught graduate-level groundwater courses at both the University of Houston and Rice University. Before I turn it over to Dr. Sale and Dr. Newell, I'd like to remind you to please put your phones on mute right now. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, please hit *6 right now, and you can hit #6 to unmute it. Again, please do not put us on hold, as that will be disruptive to the seminar. Tom and Chuck, I'll turn it over to you now.
Thanks a lot, Andrea. This is Tom Sale,
and this is Chuck Newell,
and we're excited to be here and present our recent work. This comes from a project that the ESTCP funded. Chuck and I and Andrea and also our co-authors, Paul Johnson, Rob Hinchy, Hans Stroh, we thought perhaps we could write a relatively short document that people could easily access all the current key ideas and that this might facilitate better use of resources and
sort of a 30-minute read was the original idea.
Yeah, I think it's more like an hour read and today it's going to be about an hour and a half presentation with time at the end for questions. And as Andrea mentioned, we're interested in questions along the way too. So Chuck, and you want to add any other introductory comments?
Well, I guess some of the things we'll talk about today is why are these sites so difficult to manage? We talk about some new ideas about how these sites work, and this whole idea of contaminant storage in low permeability zones. That's one of our key themes. And then what happens when you do remediation, and then how do you make better decisions? So those are some of the main themes of the presentation today.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges of the moment is you're planning on embarking upon some action, and you should have a clear understanding in advance what you're likely to get from it. And that's almost essential for good engineering and good science. So hopefully at the end of this, you'll have a better sense of the outcomes of potential actions.
So let's dive in. Go to slide number 2. And this just really talks about the structure of the project. The first thing we've done is actually produced the document on the left, this frequently asked questions document, and this is something you can download and read, and this is something that, about an hour, and that's what we're really going to focus on today is the information in the document on the left.
And then the document on the right is coming soon. Chuck and I are in the throes and our co-authors of pulling this together, and hopefully it'll be wrapped up by the end of the year. This will be kind of the small phone book version of the FAQs, a more rigorous review of how to select remedies and kind of a what to think about. We don't want to be prescriptive in any way, but we want to perhaps let everyone think about all potential issues and be cautious of all the things you should be thinking about. One thing on the FAQs on the left-hand side, I'm excited because now if you go and Google chlorinated solvent FAQs, we're at the top of the list. So we've made it somewhere. I've had my mom actually clicking on that site a bunch of times. Maybe that's helped a bit, but
I guess the other things we'll be talking about today are what's with these 2 graphics. The graphics on the left will be showing where that came from. This actually came from Colorado State. And in the graphic on the right, we have some woodcuts here of the Colorado River. And so let's go to slide number 3. And really we're talking about the opportunity that we saw to try to sort of improve decision making. And the graphic on the right is coming from some of Tom's experiences running rivers and kayaks. And you want to go through that? Why is that graphic here?
Mm-hmm. This actually comes from Powell's exploration of the Colorado River and its tributaries. And it's a beautiful set of lithographic plates. But also it's a great story. I think the story is somewhat analogous to our adventure with cleaning up chlorinated solvents. They start off in this great adventure not really knowing what's in front of them. And in the end, they master a bunch of skills. But along the way, they have all these experiences that they learn from. And this one here is Disaster Falls early in the trip. They come to this one rough spot, and Powell tries to pull everyone over to shore and doesn't quite do it, and one boat goes through and wrecks. And then there's all these swimmers in the water, and these swimmers are recirculating in this big whirlpool. And unfortunately, it kind of reminds me of the experience that site owners go through. They get thrown into this river and into this whirlpool, and we're on the edge trying to throw lines to them to help pull them out, but they keep going round and round and having to revisit new remedies.
But really, all stakeholders experience that at some site.
That's
what
true.
Do you do about this?
How this is a collective experience. That's exactly right, Chuck.
And so we saw it as this way to highlight current knowledge, to make better decisions, better use of resources, and in the end, make a better environment.
Right. Exactly. That's the goal, better use of resources and a better environment. Moving on to slide four, myself as an academic, there is a temptation to write articles for academics, and this is not that. We decided we're going to write this for the people who are actually making decisions, and we're not going to worry about whether we're going to get publications out or which journal it's in. So it's really written for staff that are making, and consultants and industry representatives, regulators, community representatives, because these are really the group of people that sit down at the table in the end and make decisions. So it's written for those that are making decisions, as opposed to those that want to stew about academic issues. On the right-hand side, I was really excited to look through the list of attendees. We've got people from regulatory agencies and industry and consulting and folks at DOD facilities, which looks a lot like the people we had actually written this for. So that's a hit. Also, there's representatives from 38 states and 6 countries. Not only have we made it in Clue on Google, but we've now made it on Clue-in, so that's exciting. And we want to thank all of you who are on the lines and the various formats for listening in.
Well, let's go ahead and start. And basically, the FAQ document has these 26 frequently asked questions, and we'll start with number one. I'm on slide five right now, and the first one is, what is the problem? And the problem is that We've used these chemicals, these chlorinated solvents are really central to modern day life, very valuable. But we didn't really understand how they behaved once released in the environment. So now we're managing the legacy of these past practices, the stuff that happened in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, 1980s in some cases. Now I think largely the risk associated with these pathways have been addressed in terms of that there's a relatively infrequent that you have actual impact of people currently today drinking water from these things and being exposed to them, but that there are these technical challenges that make it very difficult or impossible to clean these things up, and that makes it hard for stakeholders. And so that's sort of the background, but there is some good news too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the good news is in the last 20 years or so, we've learned an awful lot, and being equipped with a better set of knowledge, we're far better positioned to make sound investments that have consequential benefits and allow us to move on with this whole issue of managing this legacy of past practice. So, and there's a slide that comes up on, I don't know, 12 or so. It's what we used to think and what we currently think. And it's amazing, if you look at what we used to think, it's appalling to think how we ever made any progress at all. And if you think about where we're at now, there's all kinds of room for great hope as to what we can accomplish in the future. One last point on this number one slide. It's managing the legacy of our past practice, and in there there's a really critical concept. These releases happened a long time ago, 20, 30, even 40, 50 years ago in some cases, and in that time that's elapsed, these problems have changed. Chlorinated solvent releases aren't just something that happens and then they're there. You put them in the ground, and then a whole set of processes occur. And the problem changes with time. So I think it's really important for us to understand the aging of these processes. These chlorinated solvent releases, really change a lot with time, much like we as individuals, where we're born and we're little children, and then we change with time, and Chuck and I are getting kind of older now. So the problem evolves with time, and that's really a key theme that throughout this whole thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to slide number 6, there's a list of what are chlorinated solvents and why are they a concern. It's kind of interesting. The first column lists these attributes, and then the second column lists their industrial value. You know, it
chlorinated solvents from an industrial perspective and from our modern lifestyle are really invaluable things. There's a reason they were produced in such large quantities and used so widely. Unfortunately, when you go over to the third column, the right-hand column, the very attributes that make them appealing from an industrial application make them quite challenging from an environmental one. So just to start off, volatile is one of the attributes in the upper left-hand column. It's good for cleaning. You know, you can wipe it off on an aircraft wing and it volatilizes or clean some kind of electronic chip or something, and it volatilizes. It goes away. That's great.
But downside, it forms these vapor plumes in the soil.
Yeah, and then the next one, it's chemically stable under typical aerobic conditions. So if you have a commercial product and you want to use it for cleaning and it degrades, that's not so good. But if it's stable, that's far more appealing. Makes it easy to store. But on the other hand, the downside is it's really slow to degrade in aerobic soils, and you need to underline that aerobic thing. Another attribute is non-flammable, which is great. You know, imagine trying to clean an aircraft with a flammable liquid and the consequences to workers.
Historically, people used gasoline as a dry cleaning fluid, so, which occasionally there would be some accidents and leading to the expression of a really hot fashion that would occur. Sort of joke there, but these things are much more safer from this explosion, fire hazard and perspective and improved worker safety. But then,
right.
You get out there, and then it's different because they're very stable in the environment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly soluble in water is the fourth attribute in the left hand. So that's good from a cleaning. You can mix it and separate the liquids. And on the other hand, the downside of being slightly soluble is that small releases contaminate huge amounts of water. And then density, it's because the liquids are denser, you can easily separate out the separate phase liquids, which is kind of nice. And on the other hand, when you go over to the environmental challenges, they can sink through aquifers and make it very problematic to know where the end of the contaminant is. And lastly, low viscosity is appealing. It's easy to clean on surfaces. And on the other hand, as a separate phase liquid, it can move quickly through porous media. So just as one comment on the FAQs, they start off with these relatively simple concepts and ideas, and in the end, we're going to work into more challenging and difficult questions. But these are the foundations that set the basis for the subsequent materials. So moving on to 7.
We have this discussion of what happens when chlorine solvents are released to the surface. Here we've got a photograph of some of this great original research by Friedrich Schwille in Germany, who did a lot of this work before the folks in North America really were focused on this. And there's this great book that he talks about these laboratory experiments where he releases this stuff. And in this case, he's releasing it in the sand tank, and you can see the material penetrate below the water table, this dyed bean apple.
Schwille's work was really remarkable. It set the foundation for us as we embark on managing chlorinated solvents in the 80s and 90s. But there's something interesting about his work. He does it in these wonderful visualization studies in relatively uniform materials in sand tanks, and he instantly adds bean apple. So he's really only looking at the problem in its very earliest stage. So imagine if Schwille had let this tank sit for 50 years. Would it look like this 50 years later? And that's really the condition that we have. And would it look like this 50 years later if it was more than just homogeneous sand? It's interesting. We do all these, and we do them here at CSU as much as anybody, these beautiful sand tank studies. And they can be misleading because the real world is heterogeneous and the real world time plays a big part in the equation.
And so that's one of our key themes in the FAQs is this aging of sites. So we move on to slide number 8. Then we have really three series of slides of these conceptual models from the show. Here's the early stage, and this is right after the release occurs. And I did a lot of work with sort of getting the word out about Dean Apples in the early 1990s, so giving a talk at this Dean Apple Roadshow at a series of places, Dean Apple Fact Sheets. My message at that time was, if you have a chlorinated solvent site, there was a good chance you had this Dean Apple material out there, and this is what it looked like. And then the message was, you have to find this stuff, and if you get the Dean Apple out, that site's going to get cleaned up. But there's more to the story as we see as these sites age over time.
Right. In fact, this is a very common picture you'll see, and I'll add the point that the Dean apple has moved down and it's settled on top of low permeability layers. It pretends to perch on top of low permeability barriers, which are often referred to as capillary barriers. The pore throats in these low permeability barriers layers are so small that the apple can't force itself into them. It tends to become perched on top of them. And this is really the Schwille picture. I mean, this is what happens very early on. So
sort of the implied message here is that those clay layers are impervious, and there's sort of this concrete or glass or down in there.
Inert?
Yeah. Inert, and that's not the case.
It's not the case. It'd be nice if it was, actually. We would be a lot better off. Moving on to slide 9, let's think about what happens in this setting at a middle stage. And at a middle stage, there's the Dean apple. There's still some of it pooled on top of these capillary barriers, but we've formed a vapor plume. That's that yellow crosshatch across the top. And then the solid blue, the light blue, is the dissolved aqueous phase, and that's moved down gradient. And then there's also a vertical crosshatching in the clay layers. And what we're trying to depict there is some of the contaminants have moved by diffusion into these low permeability layers. In general, low permeability layers, it's hard to get fluids flow through them, but they often have pretty large porosity.
So we're not talking about Dean apple droplets. We're talking about Dean apple dissolving in water and then diffusing into the water in the clay.
I think about this like you have a room full of people and you push them all over in one corner. They're all crowded together.
The Dean apple crowd.
And that's what the chlorinated solvents are like in the water right adjacent to this Dean apple. It's like a bunch of people crowded over in the corner of the room. And then all of a sudden you let them go, and what do? They spread out. And that's what dissolved phase chlorinated solvents do. They're all bunched up in one area, and there's this concentration gradient, and that concentration gradient drives movement by diffusion. And diffusion is really important. So one of the consequences is, and it's shown here, those low permeability layers are charged up by contaminants, but it's largely through diffusion.
And so what's happening is the Dean apple, the chlorinated solvents are in the Dean apple, it's then being transferred to the aqueous phase and then diffusing into these low permeability compartments.
Right, and the water is essentially stagnant in there. So all the flow in there is all about diffusion.
This clay is, what, about half water, something like that?
Yeah, the porosities can be 50% or even higher,
mm-hmm.
Which makes it easy for things to diffuse in. One thing to say here, we're forming vapor plumes, we're forming dissolved plumes, we're forming contaminant bodies in low permeability zones. All of that comes at the expense of the Dean apple. Every time you dissolve something, you deplete the Dean apple. There's a mass balance there. So this middle stage we might characterize as the time at which half the Dean apple or so has been depleted.
So moving on to slide 10, we get
moving on to slide 10, a late stage. And the late stage we'll define that as when all the Dean apple is dissolved. And now what you say, all the Dean apple is gone, but we still have these plumes that are emanating off where the Dean apple was originally located. And what that's about is, once the Dean apple is gone, there's these high concentration halos in the low permeability layers about where it was present, and that's releasing contaminants via back diffusion.
And this is a very different picture, because I'm a Dean apple guy from a long time ago, and the message has always been, get the Dean apple out. But at sight at this stage, the Dean apple's already gone, and so in one way, you can look at it that of all the processes that remove Dean apple are out there. You know, we have remediation processes. We have thermal treatment and Chemox and Biodeg. But it doesn't compare. I think most of the Dean apple in the world has been removed by this process of diffusion into these clays. That's the most destructive process we know for removing Dean apple from systems. Unfortunately, it's put in a place where it still acts like a source to groundwater.
That's right. Just a comment, natural aquifers, sandy aquifers, on the top we have what I'll call a sandy aquifer. Underneath there's actually a fractured sedimentary rock aquifer. But sandy aquifers are typically something that have like 3 orders of magnitude variation in hydraulic conductivity. And then furthermore, that's kind of log normally distributed. And that's your typical sandy aquifer. And by having that range of hydraulic conductivities, you have a range of groundwater flow rates. In fact, a book that was recently put out by Fred Payne and
Joe Quinnen and Scott Potter, remediation hydraulics, it says typically only about 10% of an aquifer, sandy aquifer, is conducting fluids, and the other part of it is immobile pore space or stagnant pore space. So there's these large bodies within these subsurface zones that we're working in that contain immobile pore space and that contain contaminants via diffusion
and store those contaminants in the low permeability compartments.
And the story is even more severe when you get into fractured rock, where maybe 10% is mobile porosity in a sandy aquifer. In a fractured rock, it can be a fraction of 1%.
So that's a good book. It's not on the FAQs. Remediation Hydraulics. Fred Payne's the lead author.
Yes.
But here's a question. How do you conceptualize this? We've got these cartoons, and you came up with this method to sort of think about this in these compartments. And so if we move on to slide 11.
Slide 11 is really, it's perhaps the biggest concept that we advanced in this whole, in the FAQs. And then even more so, it's the cornerstone of our decision guide. And so the 14 compartment model. And so let's step through this quick carefully and make sure that you're following us. The first column says phase and zone, and actually there's four phases that we deal with chlorinated solvents. There's a dense non-aqueous phase liquid, but that can partition into a vapor phase, and that's that little one arrow. And then that bean apple can also partition into an aqueous phase, that's that two arrow. And then this water that's is in direct contact with the soils, the solids, that they have a capacity to sorb contaminants. So that's arrow number five, and that's kind of a reversible process. So we actually have, it's not just about Dean Apple. When we're managing chlorinated solvent releases, we're managing four phases, vapor, Dean Apple, aqueous, and sorbed. That's really important.
So why are the two squares black over there that say NA under plume?
So going on, the first column is the phases. The second column says source zone. And in the source zone, we can divide that into two compartments, the low permeability zones, or essentially the pore space that's largely immobile, where we can have this contaminant storage release thing going on. And then there's the transdiffuse zone. And that's the part that's actually conducting water. So we have low permeability and transmissive compartments for each of the phases in the source zone. And then you go out to the plume, and this gets to your question, Chuck. We have a transmissive and a low permeability compartment for the vapor phase, but in the plume we don't have any Dean Apple because that would be part of the source zone. We're really defining the source, and we'll touch on this in a moment, as the area in which the Dean Apple was originally released.
So just another question about this, in terms of the low permeability zones, that includes clays, right? That can include other types of media as well. It's not just clays.
It's really about permeability contrast. If you had a gravel with a hydraulic conductivity of a centimeter per second next to a sand, with a hydraulic conductivity of 10 to the minus third centimeters per second, then the velocity in that sand is moving 1/1000th as fast as the water in the gravel. And really effectively, even though it's in a sand, that water's immobile, and that's the key concept. And it comes about not because of absolute permeability, but contrast in permeability.
The difference. And so in Twilley's sand tanks, and a lot of sand tanks, you don't have the low permeability transmissive zones because it's all uniform hydraulic conductivity, but out there in real life, you do, in nature.
Right. So just to wrap up, in the plume, we also have aqueous and aqueous phases in transmissive and low permeability zones, and we have sorb phase in transmissive and low permeability zones. So now we're looking at the system in its entirety. These are all the compartments. There's 14 of them, and we're going to employ this in a bunch of subsequent discussions. So
let's see, we have a question from Andrea.
Yes, we had a question online. It's, can you quantify a range for middle and late stage conditions?
Oh, that's a great question. So everything is going to start off being early and it's going to end up being late. And how long it takes to progress through those phases is dependent upon a number of factors, one of which is the amount of Dean Apple release. Like if you drop a thimble full, it could happen in a day. If you drop a tanker truck full, it's going to take longer. It's also dependent on the solubility of the compounds. It's dependent on the velocities of the groundwater.
And so there's no number of years involved, but it's really what we call early stage is before there's really plumes are formed, it's really the first couple of weeks or months, maybe.
Yeah.
And then the late stage is at sites, not all sites, but some sites where the Dean apple's completely dissolved away and gotten into these low perm zones. And the middle stage is where you have some Dean apple left. Is that fair?
Yeah, and the time it takes to make that journey is a function of a bunch of things, but I'd say the two big ones are the volume of the release and its solubility.
So we've talked about how many sites are in early stage, middle stage, and late stage, and I think we decided we don't know. But we had some guesses that very few are in the early stage because all these releases happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and some in the 80s. And that sometimes we're thinking half or a third of the sites are in the late stage. But, you know, you don't see Dean apple a lot of sites, so maybe it's more than that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. We've been chasing Dean apple for years, but how often do people find it in wells? And that's really uncommon. Anyways.
So move on to the next slide?
Let's move on to the next slide.
That's a good question.
I hope that answered the question. And keep those questions coming. They're helpful to us.
So now we're slide 12.
So slide 12 is mapping contaminant distribution, and that's really what slide 12 is about. It also says and technology performance using the 14 compartment model. This is really the first step, and this is about mapping the distribution of contaminants through these various phases. So the upper left hand corner says early stage, and we looked at that earlier. It's the old Schwille based image of Dean apple pools resting on clays. And if you look in the source zone, one of the boxes is bright red. It says high. And that's because most of this problem in the early stage is about Dean apple in the transmissive zone. The Dean apple moves into the transmissive zones preferentially. And so in early on, now it says moderate under vapor because we're imagining that release went through the vado zone and pretty quickly that you're going to have some kind of vapor plume forming. And it says moderate in groundwater because that water right next to that Dean apple is going to quickly get charged up with dissolved phase constituents. And then the dissolved phase constituents are in direct contact with the soil, with the soils where sorption can occur. So those are all moderate. And we've envisioned that in the plume, the only thing that we have in the plume is just a moderate in the transmissive, just a little bit of a plume is formed, but none of the compartments are charged up in the plume other than maybe that transmissive one. It's interesting that if you go to the middle stage, and how these things map out is really dependent upon your site. So these are plausible configurations, and certainly there could be variations. But as we've envisioned the middle stage here, it's all moderate. Everything is charged up. We now, if we want to clean up this site, we're challenged with dealing with contaminants in all 14 of the compartments, and all of them are significantly charged. And then interestingly, if you go to the late stage, if you look at the late stage, the Dean apple in the source in the transmissive zone, it's green.
It's gone.
It's amazing, you know, but interestingly enough, the plumes are still there. If you think about this long enough, and Chuck and I and our colleagues have been thinking about it for a while, the end state of a chlorinated solvent release is all about contaminants stored in low permeability zones. The beginning state, it's all about Dean apple in the transmissive zone, and we'll show you a bunch of experiments coming up here. The end state is all about contaminants in low permeability zones.
So just to wrap up on slide 12, this is where the contaminant distribution is, where the sort of the concentration, where the mass is, and it changes from most of it being in the Dean apple in the early stage, most of it being in these low permeability zones in the late stage.
Right.
So moving on to slide 13, this is FAQ question number 4. What is a chlorinated solvent source zone? And for this, we've sort of borrowed some definitions and concepts that sort of started to arise from a National Research Council book in 2005, and this is something you can buy online. But it talks about a source zone as a subsurface reservoir that sustains a plume, a dissolved plume. And then the second bullet sort of goes in this region. It's originally Dean apple, but it's also got these high concentration dissolved and sorb-based halos in that. And that this they go on and say that some chlorinated solvent source zones are depleted of Dean apple, which is a key concept that blew me away in the beginning. But it's a sort of this, I think, an advancement of our understanding of these sites. There are some of these sites out there where the Dean apple has dissolved into these low perm zones, but it's still a source zone.
You know, this was one of the hardest things about this committee. I was on this committee, and we met 7 or 8 times, and it was really a wonderful dialogue. But this one we really got stuck on.
Just the definition of
what the source is. Some people want to say, well, the source is Dean Apple. And I said, but this Dean Apple doesn't last forever. And it forms these halos. And this really builds on a lot of work that Beth Parker has been doing over the years. Give her credit. Beth has been studying contaminant storage in low permeability zones for 15 years.
Beth Parker University of Guelph.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, we really struggled with this idea. And in the end, it was this concession that plumes could be sustained, that sources could include more than just Dean Apple, and we'll carry that on some more in subsequent discussions.
So moving on to slide 14, this is FAQ number 5. Why do we keep finding new challenges?
And yeah, it's amazing over the years. In the 1960s, and this is my little sketch, it's supposed to be a lake, and you can't see anything in it. In the 1960s, we did not see this problem. We were unaware of chlorinated solvents as being an issue. We were doing land disposal, and we were drinking groundwater, and a lot of the plumes simply hadn't gotten to water supply wells. And all that. The other key, too, just historically, was analytical methods weren't very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we couldn't detect low concentrations, and all of a sudden, purge and trap, and a number of other analytical methods come along, and all of a sudden, we can see three orders of magnitude lower than we'd ever been able to see before. And
so Tank on Chair Dean Apple book goes into that in a lot of detail,
yeah.
So it's very fascinating how that was this one thing that sort of started to uncover these problems. These problems start to emerge then. If we move on to
the next slide, 15, is imagine that there's actually a monument buried in that lake or submerged in that lake, and the water levels are going down over time, and we see more and more of the problems. So what happens in the 70s and 80s is we start sampling water from wells. If you think about it, water from wells, that's water that comes from the transmissive parts of the aquifer. You pump a water well, and the water comes through the highly transmissive units, and you pull that water sample, and you say, I've got chlorinated solvents in water.
And that's like the 1970s, 1980s.
Yeah, and that was what we perceived as the problem. And
then there's some more research that goes on, a lot of it coming out of John Cherry's group at the University of Waterloo, other places, about that there's this other form of these contaminants out there, and that's this Dean Apple stuff. And
well, sites weren't cleaning up, so everybody says, oh, it's Dean Apple. And to think about it, 20 years ago, a lot of that problem was Dean Apple. And in fact, part of this problem is the problems we're dealing with are evolving with time. But anyways, everybody said, oh, it's Dean Apple. And then in the early 2000s, people say, well, it's dissolved in sword phases and low permeability zones and source zones. People start actually going into source zones that haven't cleaned up, and they start looking in those low permeability layers, and they're like, uh-oh, there's something there, and that's part of the problem. And then we get into the mid-2000s, and vapor comes along, and most of us, I think, are aware of that. That's really been challenging. It's not just about groundwater anymore, but it's now about, there's another primary exposure pathway.
Another pathway.
Vapor, mm-hmm. Indoor air. And I think the last thing we've stepped into is this plus, the last one, lower left-hand corner, dissolved in sorb phases in low permeability zones in plumes. And that's kind of scary. We can have contaminants stored in plumes, and some of these older sites, there might be as much or more mass stored in the plume than there is left in the source zone. And that's kind of one of the forefront issues of the moment in terms of research and also remediation, and we'll work on that some more.
Yeah, so let's hope the water level doesn't get any lower, but that's sort of this evolution of thinking over time. We've got some other slides on that coming up, too.
I'd really like to think we've drained the lake here, but Rob Hinchey made one comment. He said, what about stabilizing agents in chlorinated solvents? There may be one or two surprises or emerging contaminants.
Dioxane and things
like that. Dioxane, right. Mm-hmm.
So moving on to slide 16. This one is FAQ number 6. Why is it common for source delineation efforts to miss a portion of the source? And so here we've got these various ideas. Some of them we've talked about before, I think. People have got some idea that the Dean Apple, when it's there, it's in these small fingers, small pools, ganglia. It's heterogeneous distributions. It's hard to find. Another reason is sometimes we use these wells with these 5-foot screens or 2-meter screens, and you get a different picture when you're pulling out information from those compartments. Remember, the third one at older release sites, maybe the Dean Apple is no longer there. You're looking for it. You've got some anecdotes about that.
One of my favorite stories, there's three times where I've worked with colleagues, and we've had $1 million, and we said, let's go find the Dean Apple. And we pull out Mercer and Cohen's book about Dean Apple site evaluation, and which is an EPA publication in 1991, and use all their tricks with SUDAN4 dyes and all kinds of great stuff. And
only one site we found any. After three sites, each $1 million, and I remember that was one little vial. We put some SUDAN4, which actually partitions into the napple, and shook it up and found a little droplet. So $3 million later, we have three sites. We were looking for Dean Apple, but and yet they were persistent plume heads.
And so in the science knowledge at that time was that you have to find a Dean Apple and get it out.
Right.
And so now what we're saying is there's a new conceptual model. At some of these sites, the Dean Apple may have dissolved away.
Right. Other things that constrain us is it's hard to resolve sometimes, particularly look at the late stage, where the source begins and the plume ends. It's gradational between the two as you get into the older releases. It's not clear. And oftentimes we're forced, out of common sense or necessity, to proceed with limited data sets. We simply want to move on with things. And
there was one comment that I think it was Rob or Paul that came up that says that there's an emphasis in the United States to do, for some of these projects, performance-based contracting. And that is something that where people want to go out and put a remedy in, perhaps without a lot of detailed characterization. And so that's another reason sometimes you miss the source. You might remediate over here, but there's another location you didn't remediate, and it turns out there's source materials there.
Just real quickly, another story I always like to tell. There's three sites that I've worked at where we put slurry walls around source zones, what we thought were source zones. And each time we said we wanted all the, you know, drilling on 15 or 20-foot centers along the alignment of the wall. And people yelled at us, said, oh, that's crazy. And then we turned around and used that as the basis for putting the wall in and found out that there was something outside the wall. So it's simply not an easy thing to do, to fully delineate the extent of sources.
So let's move on to slide 17, and here we're going to sort of focus in on this idea of how monitoring wells give us this information and perhaps miss some of the information in the compartments, and so this is an application of the 14-compartment model, but in terms of monitoring. We're really going to look at the top graph here, not look at the numbers on the bottom.
Right. So this is actually an aside. This is not in the decision in the FAQs, but it is in the decision guide. The red, yellow, and green denote how much contamination. Just going back to our previous presentation, red is high, yellow is moderate, green is low in terms of contaminant levels. So if you look at this is, it says, character of a type 3 setting at late stage. Type 3 is that's just our label for a sandy aquifer, a heterogeneous sandy aquifer. So in this case, it's late stage. That green bar occurs in the Dean Apple of the transmissive zone. There isn't any Dean Apple. It's all gone. The yellow is moderate contamination, and you can see all the distribution. Now there's also these other columns next to the colored ones, and they're either black, gray, or white. And that tells you what a monitoring well and sampling groundwater tells you about those compartments. So all the black ones, the monitoring well isn't telling you anything. For example, this shows that the monitoring well isn't telling you anything about the low permeability zones, because the water you pull only comes from the transmissive zones. And then also the monitoring well doesn't tell you anything about the vapor plume. So those are all black. In fact, the only ones that it really tells you a lot about is the aqueous phase and the transmissive zones, and those are white. The other ones are gray. So it's interesting. We're now using the 14-compartment model to look at the full scope of the problem. And what there's a little score in the bottom right-hand corner. It says 16%. The monitoring well only tells you about 16% about what you really need to know about in this situation, which is pretty amazing considering monitoring wells have been our primary tool for site characterization. All kinds. So why have we been missing lots of this problem? Well, our primary tool hasn't told us anything about a whole bunch of the compartments.
Yeah. And so that's the 14-compartment model applied to monitoring well. Let's apply it to remediation technologies in one of our favorites, pump and treat.
Slide number 18 is the same game. The yellow, red, and in this case we don't have green, denotes the amount of contamination. So this one actually says type 3 setting, middle stage. So the type 3 setting, we still have some Dean Apple left, maybe half of it or so is still present, of the original release is present as a dense non-aqueous phase, but all these other compartments are charged up too. Now if in this case we're going to contemplate putting a pumping well into the source zone and pulling water out.
And so that's pretty effective for the aqueous phase in the transmissive zone if that was the only problem we had to face. The problem is when we reduce the concentration in the aqueous phase, all these other compartments that are crowded full of people that want to spread out jump back into the other compartment. So by diffusion and or desorption, transfer, all these, by depleting one compartment, we get a feedback loop from all the other compartments. And it's interesting, by cutting off the source here, that's the white part, we're pumping the water, you will affect the down gradient plume. You'll reduce the loading to the down gradient plume, which is a good thing, but the problem is when you reduce the loading to the down gradient plume, then these other feedback loops come in the down gradient plume.
You're going to recontaminate that water.
You're going to get these feedback loops. So it's kind of interesting. You can start mapping the fluxes associated with any given action.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to slide 19, and this is FAQ 8, and we're going to sort of take a detour here and sort of do some focused. I think we've got about 20 slides that really go into some of the research about why contaminants in low permeability zones are important. And we'll explain why this particular graphic here, which I call the Hollywood Squares graphic. There was a show, TV show in the United States where these people were in these different squares. But we'll say, what is that stuff, these green and blue pictures here? And that will be part of the things we'll talk about. But now we'll sort of take a detour and really go into the science behind this, both modeling and tank studies. Why are contaminants in low permeability zones important?
Originally, we had a 3S cover of this document, and Jeff Marcusi, who runs the ESTCP program, and among other things, said you should really have a cover that talks about the primary concepts of this document. This cover is about contaminant storage and release in low permeability zones, and that's really perhaps the core theme of this document. So moving on to slide 20. These are excerpts from some recently funded ASCE research and work that DuPont has been supporting this on over the years. And it's work that's been done at Colorado State University, and some of it's also been done by Colorado School of Mines. So moving to slide 21, let's just do a quick thought experiment. We talked about this earlier. Imagine you have a chlorinated solvent release. The DNAPL moves down, and it pools on top of a low permeability layer that perches that DNAPL. And what's going to happen to that DNAPL? We emplace it on top of this low permeability zone, and what's going to happen? And one thing, there's a little arrow immediately above the red block, which is our DNAPL pool, and that's showing there's a diffusive flux off the top of this thing, and then the water's flowing off the top, over the top, sweeping it down gradient. A little bit of water actually flows through the body of the DNAPL pool. That's that itty-bitty arrow down gradient. And then there's these arrows into the clay. And what that's all about is... there's a high concentration at the contact that drives diffusion into the low permeability zone, and that occurs not only immediately beneath the pool, but down gradient along that contact. So that's our thought experiment, and
let's see what happens when you do this in the tank.
Let's do it in the tank. So this is actually an experiment that Tisa Longa-Sakari and Bart Wilkins, a student of Tisa's at School of Mines, did. So this here's our sand tank, and it's about foot and a half long and a foot and a half high. On top, there's a coarse sand, and then there's just a fine sand below. There's actually about two orders of magnitude contrast in hydraulic conductivity. And then that red body is a DNAPL pool that was in place. It's about 2.5 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And the really cool thing about Tisa's lab is he has an X-ray source and an X-ray detector that moves on either side of that pool, and it measures the amount of DNAPL by adsorption that's there through time.
So in this picture, that red dot is sitting on top of the fine-grained sand.
That's right.
Sort of see the
red block.
The red block. You can sort of see it in the photograph, but it's sitting on this finer sand, and that's what it's going to diffuse into.
So Tisa and Bart do two things. They measure the disappearance of the DNAPL, and they measure the cumulative discharge of the dissolved phase out of the tank as a function of time. And the data's on the right, but that's too small. If we move on to slide 23, it's blown up. So let's start with the pink boxes. It starts in the upper left-hand corner, and that's the total amount of DNAPL that's present in the tank.
But this is a y-axis is the sort of the cumulative trichloroethane that's there in milligrams, and the x-axis is lapse time in days.
Thank you, Chuck. Mm-hmm. We're going to try and remember to do that on every graph, or I'm so used to looking at these, it's just second nature to jump into. But anyway, so Chuck's exactly right. Y-axis is total mass, and x-axis is time. The pink boxes, it starts off at 15,000 milligrams or 15 grams. So that's about a quarter of a coffee cup full of vault liquid. And through time, it goes down because it's dissolving. And interestingly enough, by 5 days where that bright red bar is, it's fully dissolved.
X-rays don't see any of it.
The Dean apple is gone.
Okay, now I thought Dean apple was supposed to last for centuries.
It doesn't last for centuries. Now, this is a really soluble Dean apple. That's part of the reason it goes quickly. But
and raises a lot of water through there, right?
If you buy into the idea that you're forming plumes all the time, vapor or groundwater, it's coming at the expense of the Dean apple, and a day comes when the Dean apple is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So here's another part of the graph that the blue triangles are the cumulative mass that's discharged out of the tank in the aqueous phase through the transmissive zone, and it climbs with time. There's little gaps in the data because Bart's wife was pregnant and he decided he'd go home at night. So that's why there's those little gaps in there. And interestingly enough, it rises, and at 5.5 days where the blue triangles cross the red line, only 2/3 of the mass have discharged out of the tank.
So there's still a source zone there.
Well, a third of the mass has diffused into that low permeability zone. In 5 days, fully a third of that Dean apple mass moved into this low permeability layer in this relatively short tank. If the tank had been longer, even more of it would have moved in.
Now, same thing would happen if this had been TCE, but TCE is a lower solubility, and so that x-axis would have been a lot longer.
Just the time scale would expand.
Yeah.
Right.
Same pattern, same everything.
Now, here's one thing I really like about this experiment. The slope of that line, the blue triangle line, is the rate of mass discharge out of the tank. And here's the question. Can you tell by the mass discharge rate when the Dean apple is gone?
And the answer is no. The only way that Tita and Bart knew the Dean apple was gone was because the x-ray said it was gone.
This is really remarkable.
But you can't tell from the concentration data that the Dean apple dissolved away. So that source zone sort of changed from a dissolution of Dean apple to this back diffusion from this low permeability compartment, and you can't see the signal really.
Two quick lessons. Diffusion can drive lots of contamination into low permeability zones, and after the source is gone, it can sustain substantial release.
Let's put some modeling.
So, and here I'm on slide 24, and I've got the PowerPoint version up. I have to click on it twice, and then I get two blocks under source on. There's a block under source on and source off. And here's the game we're going to play. We'll pretend the source is on for a while, and we'll contemplate how much mass is in the low permeability zones, and then we'll contemplate the effects of removing that source on water quality in a typical well with a 10-foot screen. So this was recently published in Journal of Contaminant Hydrology.
Slide 25.
Slide 25. Thanks, Chuck. And this is a map of the distribution of aqueous phase concentration. That's the first column. The first column, we're going to assume there isn't any retardation at all. At 1,000 days, the source is on, and we see there's a plume that's formed, and I should explain the axes here too. The y-axis on these is a dimension in terms of meters, and it's really only 1 meter of height. And we're going to look at a 1 meter thick section of the aquifer.
In the Z direction.
In the Z direction, the vertical, and then 100 meter in the down gradient plume or X direction.
So this is a cross-section slice parallel to groundwater.
Through a plume, and we have this two-layer system. And I should say this comes from an exact analytical solution that it was really painful to solve. But this is an exact analytical solution. Anyways, 1,000 days, upper left-hand corner, no retardation. You see contaminants are moving into the low permeability zone, and the plume is marching on down gradient. And then at moving into the second box in the first column at 1,250 days, the source has now been off and the plume is moving out of the transmissive zone. But what you're starting to see is the concentration gradients have reversed and it's driving outward diffusion into the plume. The lower left-hand corner, we've kind of zoomed into the ISA concentration lines. The source has been gone for 500 days now. There's still a plume, and that plume is emanating. The source is actually the low permeability zone.
So this back diffusion is not only occurring where the Dean apple was, it's occurring everywhere that plume was in contact with the silt.
Right.
And that's 100 meters down gradient.
Yep. So it can sustain plumes for long periods of time. The right-hand set of columns, we look at R. R is the retardation factor. So we're looking at a retardation factor of 3 in the sand. So that slows the rate at which the plume advances. We're looking at a retardation of 15 in the silt. And why would you have such a higher retardation factor in the silt? Well, these low permeability layers
have a lot more surface area, and often they're deposited in quiescent environments, which would be have far higher organic carbon content.
A geology thing.
Yeah, a geology thing. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, it's interesting with these higher retardation factors, what you find out is the contaminants are almost magnetically drawn into this low permeability zone. It turns out there's actually a lot of carbon in plumes, and particularly in low permeability zones, that can attenuate contaminants. So that's just to prove that, you know, contaminant storage in low permeability zones does happen.
It's a big deal.
Moving on, and I'll just trouble you with one more kind of detailed slide. This is really important. This contemplates what's going to happen in a well down gradient of the source. And so on these graphs, we have normalized concentration on the y-axis, and then we have time. And I have to note a correction here. It says time in days, and this is an old slide. It's actually time in years. So the x-axis is time, 0, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. In this case, the source is on for 5 years, and then we'll contemplate what happens in terms of water quality in the well for an additional 15 years. The black line is a well that's 100 meters down gradient. The blue dotted line is just 10 meters down gradient, and then the red line is only 1 meter down gradient. So let's just think about the well at 100 meters first off. In the upper left-hand corner, you shut off the source at 5 years. 15 years later, at 20 years total elapsed time, you've seen about 1.5 orders of magnitude improvement for quality. Now, if you go down in the first column, and we'll contemplate different retardation rates, if we increase the retardation rate in that low permeability zone, that improvement in water quality at 100 meters goes down to about an order of magnitude. It's pretty upsetting or disconcerting that we can remove a source, and 15 years later, maybe we only see an order of magnitude improvement in water quality.
An order of magnitude sounds like a lot. It's 90%.
It is 90%. You know, and if you were close to MCLs, it might get you to MCLs.
If you were at 50 parts per billion CPE,
right.
You'd make it. But if you're at 500, you still got another order of magnitude to go. But if you're at 5,000 ppb, you're not very far along the road to get there.
The lower left-hand corner just contemplates more retardation. The right-hand is really important. It contemplates if contaminants are degrading at a reasonable rate. If contaminants are degrading in those low permeability zones, and particularly the contaminants diffuse in, they're destroyed by natural attenuation processes in the low permeability zones, and when that happens, they can't diffuse back out. So that's the story in the upper right-hand corner. The fact is that what diffuses in gets destroyed in situ by natural processes, and then it isn't available to diffuse back out.
And those natural processes could be, for example, in clay, some of this abiotic degradation by iron and things of this nature. If it's a silt, it's a low permeability zone, or a low permeability sand, then biodegradation could occur because the bacteria can fit into the pore space
there. Actually, it's fascinating. Some of these low permeability zones, the mineralogy is horribly complex. You've got all these clays and surface area and reduced minerals potentially, and they're very active geochemical systems. So in situations, bottom line, you're not always going to have this plume persistence. Unfortunately, it seems that you often do. And we won't go any further with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want you to think that this is always the case. So you'll find exceptions, and one of the key exceptions is when you have reactions in low permeability zones going on.
How about another thought experiment? Let's go to slide 27.
Slide 27 is a plume advancing into a sandy aquifer that's heterogeneous, and so there's this one little transmissive layer. The contaminants move in. They diffuse into the low permeability zone. That's the middle section. You see this outward loss. And then on the last one, and this is important, we've envisioned that the source has been cut off by some engineered measure or perhaps just natural depletion of the source.
Or there's a barrier or there's a lot of remediation done in that zone, and so the flux going into this downgrading plume is really a lot lower.
So all of a sudden we have relatively clean water moving through there. This causes outward diffusion from the low permeability zone. But if you look at those arrows, they're pointing back to the low transmissive zone, but they're also pointing back into the low permeability zone. And this is kind of an insidious aspect of this problem. All the while that it's diffusing back out into the transmissive zones, it's also diffusing further in to the low permeability zones. And that creates kind of a hysteretic process where it goes in much faster than it comes out. The problem is that slow release gives us much time for it.
And so you can spend a lot of money cleaning out that transmissive zone, but it's going to get recontaminated.
And this is why we often see rebound with select remediation technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to slide 28, just a quick laboratory experiment. We set up 6 sand tanks, and they all had this a sand layer, 5 centimeters, and then 2 bedded layers of sands and silt. The sands are the dotted yellow lines. And then we thought, and these are all soils from a local DOD facility, F.E. Warren Air Force Base. We just took the natural silt from the site. And then we also thought, what if we put activated carbon in that silt? And what if we put some zero-valent iron in there? There's a dry compaction in those low permeability zones. What's going to happen? So we did this with PCE and TCE.
And just to make sure we got the picture here, you're flowing water left to right.
Correct. Through these tanks.
And the question is, how much of this math ends up in the experiment sealed with no amendments? And originally when I saw this, I said, well, maybe 1% of that mass is going to get in there. Activated carbon, I thought maybe 10% is going to get in there. But you actually measured it and came up with the answers.
Right? Yeah, in fact, if you have a pencil in hand, write down your guess. We'll just do the PCE numbers.
Mm-hmm.
What fraction of the total contaminant mass, after 25 days of flushing, what fraction of the total contaminant mass added do you think is in the silt
mm-hmm.
with no amendments,
mm-hmm.
with activated carbon, and with zero valent iron?
And let's make it the person with the best guess wins a new car.
And I've actually got an 89 Camry with 207,000 miles on it.
That's what they win.
Perfect.
Okay. So dissolve based stuff, PCE's flowing left to right, and you run this thing for how long?
25 days.
25 days. What percent of that dissolve phase loading ends up in the silt with no amendments? And then for these other two phases.
So hopefully you've got 3 numbers written down, the no amendments, the activated carbon, and the zero valent iron. So I'm going to flip to the next slide.
Slide 29.
Oh, I forgot. Slide 29 just shows the laboratory setup. Actually, we ran these tanks vertically, and there's reasons for that. But here you just have a sense of what the experiment looked like.
Okay.
Sand tanks, the layers that are dark are actually the silt layers. They filled first due to capillary rise.
So slide 30 shows the mass balance.
Slide 30, the left-hand set of blocks, is PCE. No amendments, the blue-purple color. Over 35% of the contaminant mass and moves into that low permeability zone in 25 days.
Okay. My guess was 1%, so it's off by a factor of 35.
You don't get the car, Chuck.
Oh, shoot.
With the ZVI, it's actually the contaminants have moved into that. More contamination has moved into that because the contaminants are degrading in there, and that actually creates a steeper concentration gradient. But the number that blows me away is with the 1% activated carbon. Almost 80% of the contaminant mass moves into those low permeability zones in that experiment.
It is like a magnet. It just,
it is, yeah,
sucking that stuff in.
And it really illustrates reaction and absorption are two of the key processes that we have to deal with in this whole thing.
So is there any way we can actually visualize this, though, and really, really see it more vividly?
So we've been struggling with this for, I don't know, 6 years. We've done laboratory studies, and we've done, we've solved partial differential equations, and the thing that's really scored in my own mind personally and everyone else that we visit with is slide 31. Slide 31, a student, Leanne Doner, was working on all this stuff. She's a math major, and I said, you got to build a sand tank. And your intuition's not going to work until you just see it for yourself. So Leanne loaded a sand tank, and it's about a meter square. And A, B, and C, and D are bentonite, pure bentonite clay layers. She just put bentonite in there and let them hydrate up.
Hydraulic conductivity 10 to minus 8 centimeters per second?
It could be even lower than that. And then the sand is a beautiful, clean quartz laboratory sand. Hydraulic conductivity 10 to minus 2nd or something. So, you know, maybe 6 orders of magnitude more transmissive.
And so we're going to show about, 10 slides that show this. But there's also this movie you can download after the talk. You can download from ClueIn. You can also download it from the GSI Environmental webpage if you want. And it's a 2-minute movie that shows this progression over, 132 days.
Yep.
So we're going to just do a couple of excerpts for this talk and show you what happens in the movie.
Okay, here's day 1. And day 5, we're flushing fluorescein through the tank here, and we've been doing this for 5 days now. And you see the fluorescein is moving through the sand tank, through the transmissive zones. There's any movement into the low permeability, there's no flow, so anything that goes into the low permeability zones is not advection, but something different. Moving on to slide 33, we're at 11 days, and here the tank is fully saturated with this emerald green, beautiful fluorescein.
And this is in the dark room.
This is in the dark room. We've got UV lights on, and we're taking photos.
if you look at A, the leading edge of A, it's starting to turn green. And that's because of diffusion. That's that crowd at the edge trying to disperse into the vacant space adjacent to it.
Again, how thick is A in
centimeters? A is about 2 inches or 5 centimeters.
Okay.
And then B is about maybe 5 times as thick as that, so 25 centimeters, almost a foot.
Mm-hmm.
B, you can see the edges are turning yellow, but the interior still is all green. C is largely saturated. D, and you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on to slide 34, the green colors are moving further and further in. And moving on to slide 35, now the source is only on for 23 days. And now you can see that the fluorescein's flushing out. Moving on to slide 30.
And the plume's still there, though.
The source is gone, but look at the head tank on the right-hand side. It's still all full of fluorescein. And it's because you're now getting back diffusion,
mm-hmm.
back into the transmissive zones. Slide 37, there's just a little enhanced blow-up. I'm going to go on to slide 38. It's interesting, on slide 38, now the edges of these bodies are turning dark, but the interiors are all green. In fact, even the middle of B is green at this point. And 39 shows the same problem. So at 132 days, slide 40 shows the breakthrough curve. And the main thing about this is there's this long tail that sweeps out with time. The source is off, but we still have persistent release of contaminants.
And this is about 20 pore volumes of flushing. And there's some rough rules of thumb that pump and treat systems might do a couple pore volumes a year. So this is a lot of water that's gone through here.
Right, mm-hmm. right, on a relative scale. The it's interesting that the blue line is actually a model that was done by Steve Chapman and Beth Parker. They're formerly at the University of Waterloo, now at the University of Guelph. Steve, to capture these processes in a numerical model he was using a finite element model, you have to capture those localized diffusion gradients. I think Steve used 10,000 nodes in this square meter tank.
So NT3D and those type models won't capture this problem.
Well, imagine if you're using nodes that are on the size of square meters. You're never going to capture these diffusion processes. So you have to be careful. A lot of the modeling efforts we've done historically weren't really equipped to capture these processes. So moving on to 41, see Back Diffusion the movie. It's available at the CLUIN website.
And let's go to our field site.
Slide 42, and this is just our last bit about proving to you that contaminants in low permeability zones are consequential. This is Pueblo Chemical Depot, and it's in southern Colorado, and we installed a electrolytic reactive barrier along the dotted line, and we'll have a report on that shortly. Slide 43, it's really cool. It's titanium window screen hung through the plume and then charged up by photovoltaic cells, and it's all passive and exciting, and we're excited about it. The problem is we got 99% or 95% reduction at the barrier, and then 10 meters down gradient, we were back to 80% of the concentrations we were seeing up gradient of the barrier. And we're like, what's going on? We're getting this rebound. So a colleague of ours went in and very carefully drilled through the transmissive zones and into the underlying pure shale, coincidentally 2% FOC, fraction of organic carbon. And Dave actually measured the concentrations. And what these graphs have is depth versus concentration of different energetic compounds. There's these huge spikes. In fact, at this site, the source is an upgrading of the barrier. It's underneath the plume. And what's going to sustain this plume is back diffusion of these contaminants out of the low permeability zone. Pretty amazing.
It's neat stuff.
It's a different conceptual model than we showed up at the site. We thought the plume, the source was upgrading of us, and ironically, it's underneath.
Another good example of this is Beth Parker and Steve Tappan's paper in 2005, talked about this Connecticut site.
Yeah, probably the keynote paper on this topic is Chapman and Parker, 2005, in Water Resources Research.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck, number 9.
Well, let's move on to slide 45, and we're going to go back. So that was sort of our focus on why low permeability zones and storage in them is important. So slide FAQ number 9, why are contaminants in the vato zone important? And there are really two things we talked about, and this question came up during the review process where they said, let's add this. We didn't have any about the vato zone in the beginning. But we did add this FAQ as part of the review process where we had people review the document. But vato zone's a source, and you can sort of map this out with the same 14 compartment model. And we described that most, but not all chlorinated solvent sites are dominated by saturated zone sources, but there's some where this vato zone is important. And soil moisture is a key thing if you're trying to remove that. If you have dry site, much better performance of SVE getting stuff out of fine-grained units. And, of course, the VEDO zone is also a pathway. It's a difficult one to interpret. There's a lot of work being done by ESTCP and CERTIP has funded people to look at empirical studies and model development. But it's hard to go to a house, I'm sure as many of you know out there, and figure out, is the solvent you see in that house coming from a groundwater plume, or is it coming from gun cleaner or consumer products or whatever? Go to the next slide, 46, it shows a graph of, on the x-axis, groundwater concentration from plumes in micrograms per liter. Y-axis, I think the
right.
Fallen out there, but it's in micrograms per cubic meter. And it shows there is a relationship between groundwater concentration and indoor air concentrations. That's the on the y-axis. But that the most, a lot of these sites, they fall into what the background concentration is that you find out at, height, how, at houses or structures that are not over plumes themselves. And so distinguishing between background concentrations for some of these solvents in a house and what's coming from a plume is difficult to do. And so we talk about that in FAQ number 9.
It's interesting, too. Vapor is becoming a driver for remediation. It's relatively easy to mitigate exposure via groundwater pathways, but these vapor pathways that are underneath homes, you just can't make those go away. You can't put an alternate supply of water. So vapor is becoming a big driver. Moving on to slide 47, and we alluded to this earlier on, what have we learned in the last half a century? And on the left-hand side it says the old school paradigm, and the right-hand side it says the new scale school. I had alluded to this earlier. If you live in the world on the left-hand side, the probability of success is far less than if you live in the world on the right-hand side. So we just thought we'd write down some of the key of evolutions over time, and Chuck said this slide was too difficult to read and wordy, and cleverly simplified it on slide 48, Chuck.
So, slide 48, what have we learned in the past half century? The old paradigm is land disposal of chlorinated solvents is okay. And that, turns out, well, maybe that's not such a great idea. The great example of this is anybody involved in any litigation projects. There was a standard by the American Society of Testing Materials, and this is from the 60s all the way up to the early 70s, that said if you have spent solvents from a degreaser, just go out and pour it on the ground because it will evaporate. And as we know now, it turns out not such a great idea.
Not such a great idea. Another vision we had moving into the late 70s and early 80s was that it was a problem involving chlorinated solvents and water, and if we just pumped them out, it was going to be like emptying a tank.
And my experience was is that when I first started in this business in the late 1980s, is that I actually cleaned up a site completely, one in New Mexico with pump and treat, and it took me about 7 years. I did it, however, all in a computer model, the method of characteristics model, and it turned out that I was at that site last year and asked them, is the plume still there? And they said, well, yeah, it's still there. It persists for a long time.
So it's still there because we now understand there's all these feedback loops from these other adjacent compartments. One thing, it was widely held that there weren't any ongoing reactions occurring in groundwater systems, be it even petroleum hydrocarbons. And we've come so far in appreciating the importance of reactions in low permeability zones. And even for chlorinated solvents under select reducing conditions, naturally occurring reducing conditions,
the halococoides, you can get these dechlorinators and
readily degrade. And that's so important. And in fact, it's not only whether it exists naturally, but whether we can exploit that in engineered systems.
The old paradigm was, we're going to find some new technologies that can clean up these sites. And there's been quite an investment by taxpayer money, industry money to do this. And I think the new paradigm is that you can improve sites a lot with these new technologies, but it's rare, it's very difficult to get all the way down to drinking water standards.
You really have to empty all the compartments, and that would be the challenge. Source removal is necessary. A lot of these sites, unfortunately, they've existed long enough, perhaps smaller releases, that most of the contaminant mass may have now moved into the plume. So it isn't always true that a source action is necessary.
The old model was that it was like a cigar, and if you put out the flame in a cigar, the smoke is going to just dissipate away.
Right.
And with these new feedback loops, maybe that smoke will persist for a long period of time.
Particularly at older sites. The benefit of source actions, if there's little left in the sources, that's kind of a new thought.
Yeah.
Historically, groundwater was the big player. It was all about groundwater, and now, amazingly, I mean, people have studied vapor transport, but just now, here in the 2000s, people are saying, there's another exposure scenario that we really need to be cognizant of.
And the last one, site cleanup is the main thing we got to focus on. That was what the regulatory things were focused on. This came from Mike Cavanaugh. He says that there's an increased focus on natural resource damage assessments and sort of some sort of compensation for affecting groundwater, impacting groundwater for long periods of time. So that's a little bit about these paradigms and what's changed.
Imagine if you live on the left-hand side, just read all those beliefs, and then move over to the right-hand side and ask yourself, when are you going to be more successful? Maybe the bottom line for all this comes on slide 49. In the end, it's our opinion, the authors of this document, in the end, it's learning to value that which is attainable and beneficial. Those things that we can do that alter risks and exposure scenarios and reduce longevity perhaps. And our greatest opportunity in the future may be to value more highly what we can do and accept those things that are maybe more persistent problems. Moving on to slide 50, Chuck.
Well, this was FAQ number 12, and it says, which in-situ source treatment technology is receiving the widest use? So we talk about remediation and what people's experiences are with remediation, and we talk about there are these different variations of chemical oxidation and different ways that people do thermal treatment. If we go to slide 51, we talk about bioremediation, chemical reduction, and for example, DVI soil mixing, something Tom, you've been researching, working on, monitored natural attenuation soil vapor extraction. So we talk a little bit about these different ways that how people are going into source zones and trying to remove this stuff. And this goes on to FAQ number 13, which is on slide 52. What can you expect from these things? What happens when you do this? And this is one of our key focuses, is trying to just get the current research that's out there on if you do a treatment, what is the result?
So, Chuck, you have two sets of data here. One's kind of a qualitative study.
That's right.
And the other is more quantitative. So in the past, people have questioned this about using this data, and I think it's good. And if you read the caveats of the authors, it's really great information. But they don't know these removal amounts rigorously, and so just it needs to be taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah, this first study on slide 52 is coming from the Navy. It was based on data developed by Geosyntec. The actual graphic here was done by Jim Mercer's group at Geotrans. But it talks about these 53 sites where source mass was removed, and these pie charts sort of show which technologies are being used most. The key point about this study is this was based on a survey. They sent out these questionnaires, and people said, this is what I thought would happen. But of the 53 sites they got back, 16 folks had used chemical oxidation. Thermal treatment was used a lot, 15. There were only two surfactant projects. So you get a sense of what type of things people are doing. Now, within each one of the smaller bar charts, it talks about performance. And so if you go to the thermal treatment pie chart on the top left, this is what people think what they think happened at their site. There were 15 thermal projects. 10 of those projects, they didn't do any quantification of how much source they got out. Two of them thought they got 100% of the mass out. And you can see that there's others. One project, they thought they only got less than 25% of the mass out. So this is a qualitative study of just based on a survey, but some of the key points that only partial DNAPL mass removal can be achieved. Number two, that these MCLs, these drinking water standards, are extremely unlikely to be met. But now that's sort of the right brain study. Think about it. Let's go to real numbers. Slide 53 is a paper that my group at GSI, Travis McGuire, published in Groundwater Monitoring Remediation in 2005. And this is more quantitative, and we just have one single metric here. What happens to concentrations, what were the concentrations before remediation, and what were the concentrations in groundwater after remediation? This is in this transmissive compartment. And the graph here is the reduction in source zone treatment, or apparent concentration for chlorinated solvents. Higher up on the graph is better. And as you can look at this, enhanced by remediation, we have 26 sites where we could get this data and look at concentrations before and after. And the median percent reduction, the red dot, was about a 95% reduction in concentration, a lot higher than I thought it would be. Chemical oxidation, say an 88% reduction. The whiskers showed the distribution, and so there was one enhanced by remediation site that only had a 30% reduction. But from this, we sort of started developing these rules of thumb based on the Navy study in this and some other studies that are in the FAQs. There's a great study that we summarize in a few sentences about thermal remediation done by Paul Johnson. There's one that Bob Segrist did at chemical oxidation. And all these studies are sort of pointing to the same thing, And if we go to the next slide, 54, is we have this rule of thumb. And again, this is very general. A rule of thumb is a very general rule, not always applicable, but that well-implemented source remediation projects are likely to reduce source-owned groundwater concentrations by about one order of magnitude, sometimes two. And so this is this rule of thumb, that you can get one, maybe two orders of magnitude, and I think in our thought that these different studies, FAQ 13 that we talk about, sort of all support this rule.
And building on that, one option is, well, a current very topical issue is treatment trains or employing multiple remedies, either in time and space, to try and drive the results further. And Chuck and I are both on an ITRC working group on combined remedies. So you'll hear more about combined remedies. And actually, it turns out the 14-compartment model will largely be embedded in that document and provide a vehicle.
But just one other note about this rule of thumb is that seems like a lot. One order of magnitude is 90% reduction. But if you're at 5,000 parts per billion and you've got to go to 5 parts per billion, that's 3 orders of magnitude. And so getting a 90% reduction in concentration, if you're sort of in a log normal world, you're only one-third of the way there. There's still a long way to go.
Right. Mm-hmm. Each one of those nines gets harder and harder. Mm-hmm. Chuck's slide 55 talks about cost.
That's how much it costs to treat. And here we've just, again, done some surveys. This is part of a CERTA project, the data from the previous slide and this one, funded by CERTA. And this one was how much it costs. And so we went out to literature studies. We sent out surveys and got a number of sites. And we were representing it cost per volume in dollars per cubic yard. Great American units, roughly dollars per cubic meter. And the rough rule of thumb here, you can look at this and see, is that perhaps these costs are in the range of $20 to $200 per cubic yard for most of these. Some things you could say is the 6 surfactant projects we looked at were more expensive, and maybe that's one reason why surfactant treatments are being utilized less out there in the environment. Enhanced bioremediation maybe was a little bit cheaper, but generally these guys were in this range of $20 to $200 per cubic yard. And then sort of folding together these different information from FAQ 13 and 14, we came up with another rule of thumb, and that one is
that your investments on the order of millions of dollars per acre appear to have the potential to achieve one order of magnitude reductions in chlorinated solvent mass and concentration in source zones. That seems to be where we're at today. You can spend millions of dollars per acre, and you can get about an order of magnitude. And, you know, whether that order of magnitude makes sense for you is completely dependent upon the needs of the impacted community and the specific conditions of the site. Those kinds of things.
Right, and so we're not saying that don't do it, but that
right.
Sort of the cost benefit that right now, based on the data we have, that we think you can achieve at these sites.
Now really there's two components to this problem. You can reduce the concentration in the short term, but by depleting the mass, Chuck, you're also going to affect the duration of the problem.
Yeah, that's right, and we have another one coming up on that later on. But first, let's talk about the reduced loading from sources and what is the plume response. So let's go to Wyoming, state of Wyoming, and what happens there?
Slide 57. There's a source, and we have bean apple pools in it, and then there's a plane, and I think we understand the source function moderately well. There's that little arrow feeding the plume. But the question is, when you reduce the flux from the source, how does that affect downgradient water quality, particularly in a heterogeneous aquifer? So F.E. Warren is a facility, the DOD facility we've been doing your work at for a decade or more now, and it's highly heterogeneous. I really like that aspect of it. It's actually the Ogallala Aquifer, and I could go on about that for a long time, and I won't. If you go to slide 58, there's really a nice analog result. In 2000, F.E. Warren put in an iron PRD along that green line, shown on the map on the left, and there's two wells that are immediately down gradient of that well, and I believe they're fully in the shadow of the treated zone from the iron PRD. The concentrations at the wall are zero, or instantaneously zero, or effectively zero, when the wall was put in, and then these wells plot concentration versus time at these two wells, one's 40 feet, the other's 60 feet down gradient. You see the sharp response. Initially, concentrations drop, and then you see that it's kind of plateau. The concentrations are flattening, or the rate of decline of concentrations is flattening out. In the first case, you go from about 200 micrograms per liter. 5 years later, you're down to about 10. So you're getting pretty close to the MCL, and that's exciting. The lower one, you start off at about 2,500 and you go down to about 500, which is two orders of magnitude off the MCL, and you can extrapolate that line out. It's going to take some time before that gets you below the MCL. So it's just there, and there's lots of field data that looks like this.
And so for this, we generate another rule of thumb on next slide, slide 59.
And that says one order of magnitude source reduction gives one order of magnitude improvement in downgrading water quality, assuming that there's limited reactions going on in the plume. You know, that's an important qualifier. There's some other things noted, but with faster groundwater flow, it may be faster. And a few years ago, we looked at a bunch of data downgrading of iron PRBs, and there's kind of this range of 1 to 3 orders of magnitude improvement in water quality by completely cutting off the source. So our expectation shouldn't be the plumes are going to go away, but it should be that
get some improvement.
We'll get some improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So 16 is the slide I was alluding to earlier. It talks about longevity.
And this is how long it takes for a well, say in a source zone, to get to some standard. And this might be a drinking water standard. And this one talks about that it's very difficult to quantify that. There's a lot of uncertainty. But there are ways to approach this on a planning level basis. And one of the key things is that if you're looking at source concentration versus time, it's going to have this tail, and that's what this graph shows, concentration versus time, is that it sort of tails out for a long period of time due to this slow release from these other compartments. And because that tail is there, at many sites you will not get equal benefit for equal work. And what I mean by that, if you take out 90% of the mass in a transmissive zone, for example, the remediation time frame, the number of years it takes to get to drinking water standards, will not be reduced by 90%, maybe only 20%. And there's ways to quantify that. We talked about that in the FAQ. There's some of the software that's out there. Source Decay and BioBalance are two programs that my company did. You can get it on my company's webpage. NAS Tools, great work done by Mark Woodison and Frank Chappelle. And RemCore is a new product that's sort of out there, an amazing tool that's being distributed by EPA on their Cosmos webpage. This is done by Ron Falta at Clemson University. But this is a simple analytical model, and you can go in there and take out 90% of the mass and see that tail and see how many years that you save in terms of this remediation time frame. So a lot of neat work is being done on this. I think RemCore is going to be a big impact out there, and it's a great tool to help us think about remediation time frame and plumes and remediation.
Yeah, just one comment on the FAQs, and I encourage all of you to download them and read them. There's all kinds of references to other information, other resources for those who want to know more. And the FAQs, we're really trying to just kind of let you know what the answer is real quickly and then give you the opportunity to discover more on your own through other resources that are available through ESTC, CERTIP, and others.
Mm-hmm.
17.
We're looking at containment measures. We're both looking at remediation in situ source treatments, but also containment, what people are using, hydraulic containment, these PRBs, there's different variants there that we talk about, physical containment, monitored natural attenuation. And we try to get information about the performance of these things. And so on slide 62, we talk about that. And we have some of the information. This is coming from environmental John Bogan's group about these zero valent iron barriers, and he looked at 52 of these, largely ones that they had put in, and he said that 43 of these 52 were meeting regulatory expectations. So that gives you some idea that we put these barriers in, what happens there. Physical barriers,
such as bentonite slurry walls, 25 out of 29 sites with physical barriers have acceptable performance in the medium term. So a large number of these systems are working. The knock on containment strategies is you're not really doing anything about evidence. Perpetual care issue.
Can be there a long time.
M&A as a sole remedy is also occurring. And there's some of these smaller releases, interestingly enough, that I saw one site where it dropped to 3 orders of magnitude in 20 years without doing anything at all. So
you can get the source concentrations can go down naturally. We wrote a paper on that. And some of these sites, you get half-lives of, say, 6 years in that source zone concentration. It's
so
small, sort of uncontained.
Every 6 years, you're losing half the concentration.
At these sort of small, low releases.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
more soluble compounds,
mm-hmm.
too. Number 20 is all about the relative cost of containment versus treatment. And treatment is really, you have some dimension. It has a width and a height, and you multiply those. And so that gives you the area. And that if the width and the height were the same, it would be like x squared. So your costs, assuming you have a fixed unit cost, are going to accelerate as a square function.
And if you have containment, it's really just the distance of the perimeter. Your unit cost is the perimeter. So if all the sides of the box were the same, it would just be 4x. So one function is accelerating at x squared, and the other is at 4x. The problem is, when you get to big sites, the costs, even low unit costs for treatment, often exceed our capacity to fund these projects.
And we saw it in our mix of remediation projects. Most of those were done on very small sites. About, say, 3,000 cubic yards was the median treatment volume. But as you get to bigger and bigger sites, there's much more sort of the physics and the cost and economics driving more to containment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of these sites are very large, and they tend to go towards containment more often.
Mm-hmm.
Slide 20 comes from an NRC group, the NRC 2005 publication, and it specifically recognizes that selecting a technology is a function of, A, what you want to achieve, but also the hydrogeologic setting that you're working in. So if you just want to do mass removal and you're in a sandy aquifer, it's one thing. And on the other hand, if you're in a fractured rock with low matrix porosity, some kind of crystal, it's a different game. The problem that the NRC committee struggled with was people would say, oh, my technology, this technology works. And in fact, it does work relative to a specific hydrogeologic setting and relative to a set of goals. NRC 2005, it's interesting, we went through all, there's a table that's about 20 pages long that reviews all the common technologies in the hydrogeologic settings relative to a set of different. So, the potential for success is which is what the circles are. It's kind of the consumer reports diagram here. Depending on geologic settings.
So that's cube. We get this book, buy this book, and look at this cube, and it will tell you how these different technologies, there's about 15 technologies in there, how they perform in different settings, and how they perform with these different objectives.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Including MCL, but also some more less stringent goals.
Reducing flux.
Which are socially valuable, depending
mm-hmm.
upon your setting. Which takes us on to, slide 20, Jeff.
This is FAQ 20, slide 65. And this is some work that Tom and I did when we were on this expert panel for this EPA document, the CNAP Remediation Challenge. And we developed sort of a one-page decision matrix to help people figure out when is it more likely to when is source treatment more needed and when is it less needed. And so we just had these series of things. And to explain this, we thought we'd use sort of this reference, a great reference from American literature on slide 66, which is the Gladiator movie. Russell Crowe, and the idea is there are these different metrics in this decision guide or this decision matrix, and you give it a thumbs up, which means, yeah, there's more need to do source depletion, and the thumbs down is, no, there's less need. And so you sort of balance these things out. And what are these different metrics we have in there? They're on slide 67. And if, for example, if you have a source zone where you have expanding DNAPL, that's very rare with chlorinated solvents, but perhaps more likely with creosote or something like this, well, yeah, that's a thumbs up. You should do source treatment. If it's not, if it's immobile, well, there's less need to do this. We looked at things like plume status. Is the plume expanding or stable? What is the resource value? Is it a really good drinking water aquifer, or is it what we call a Bissant silt unit in Texas, something that's very low permeability, you can't get much water out of it. We look at containment cost, remediation time frame, need for cleanup, and then the next slide, 68, shows how all this is put together. And use this weight of evidence, is that site more likely to benefit from treatment? And in this case, we look at these different metrics, which are the different rows, and there's five thumbs up that say, yeah, we should do this, and there's one thumbs down. And you balance this out and say, well, this site, more likely you'd want to do it.
Kind of fun, at a couple of sites since we developed this, I've suggested that the decision-making groups use this and sit down, and everybody gets this sheet, and you go through these things, and all of a sudden you end up with all your answers piled up on one side or the other, and helps build consensus, a useful tool.
So my thought is you'd actually have Russell Crowe sitting there, and you'd show him this, and he would do thumbs up or thumbs down.
Right.
I haven't been able to arrange that yet.
Slide 69, taking stock. In the past, why haven't we been more successful? And this seems something of an intimidating question, but the thing I always go back, geotechnical engineers, if a dam fails, they figure out why. And yet, in the remediation community, we have a wealth of things that haven't worked out the way we wanted to, and that too infrequently we go back and inspect the reasons why. Here's just a couple of our thoughts. The systems weren't designed well, or they had a poor understanding of what technologies do. Look at our pump and treat example. We 20 years ago, we weren't appreciating all these feedback loops. Misunderstanding the extent and their distribution of contamination is a common issue. It's because it's hard to resolve those things within the time frames that we have. Poor recognition of uncertainties inherent in our design. Sometimes we're just not honest with ourselves about what we know and what we don't know. That can be challenging. And also stating remedial objectives that can only be achieved in really long periods of time. And I think MCLs is a great goal, but achieving that tomorrow may not be pragmatic. Thinking about when we might get there is more realistic.
Now, slide 70 is how can we set cleanup objectives that are achievable and protective? And for this, we go back to the National Research Council book from 2005, and where there was one section in there that talks about there are really two different flavors, two different types of objectives.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the preamble to the discussion Chuck is alluding to says, we really haven't done a very good job of setting our objectives and clearly stating what we're trying to accomplish, and that's a bad place to start. I think we really need to have a clear set of goals, and they need to be attainable and beneficial. Moving into goals, the NRC document says there's absolute goals, like protection of human health and the environment. And those are great. I mean, that's where we want to go to. But those aren't things that you can design a remedy on. You actually need functional objectives. You want to achieve a certain concentration at a point in time or space, or reduce flux by a factor of 10. See an order of magnitude improvement in downgrading water quality. Those are goals that we can actually work on and be successful in terms of. And
those are the functional objectives.
Those are the functional. So it's important to differentiate between the two.
Slide 71 sort of takes this National Research Council flowchart. There's the six-step process, resource remediation. Tom, you're on that panel. What's going on here?
Well, it starts off saying you need to understand the problem, and then you need to develop a set of objectives, or we often refer to them as remedial action objectives, and then you need to resolve what is attainable. And rather than just going ahead and hoping it's going to work, I think we're smart enough now with this document and also the decision guide and the wealth of things that are out there to actually have a reasonable understanding of what the outcome is before we implement the action. So there's this feedback loop under resolving what's attainable. Before we proceed, we should say, are we going to achieve our objectives, some very specific objectives, functional objectives.
That's step two and three up there.
Step two and three. And then lastly, you move on to five and six, which is about selecting remedies, and then the last step is verifying performance. And just as a footnote, this is the outline of our decision guide that will be coming out shortly.
So getting close to wrapping up now, if we go to slide 72, we go to FAQ 24, which is the second to last frequently asked questions, and that one is, how can we be more successful at site cleanup? And we have two slides on this. We have seven different thoughts. And number one was that you should think about these absolute objectives as long-term goals. Restoring groundwater the way it was, drinking water standards at some sites, that is likely to be a long-term goal.
Secondly, you need to have realistic and up-to-date understandings of what these technologies do. You know, and going back to pump and treat, having an unrealistic expectation didn't do us any good. And I really think there's enough knowledge out there that we shouldn't have unrealistic expectations anymore.
Number three is what you should have is some of these shorter-term functional objectives that sort of help you think about your progress to this ultimate absolute goal. And these could be what mass flux is, sort of this one new metric that people think about, or concentration. But it's in some ways that's a glide path that you want to make sure you're making progress towards that absolute goal.
The last one, or on this page, number four, and it's really about, I think we've been hiding our head in the sand a bit on uncertainties. And instead of hiding our head in the sand, we should embrace uncertainties and manage them, and we'll get onto that with the observational approach.
Slide 73 continues. We have just three more. Is number five is when source containment is the chosen remedial strategy, clearly communicate the long-term nature of this, and we're talking decades, just very long time, centuries, to all the stakeholders.
Yeah, and when source treatment is chosen as a remedial strategy, we need to clearly communicate the uncertainties associated with the outcomes and to all stakeholders so that no one leaves the table believing they're going to get something that they may not. We just shouldn't have unrealistic expectations when we select a remedy and walk away from the table.
And that sort of spills to number seven, that remedial actions will not always lead to the achievement of these goals and objectives, and that we should learn from experiences rather than simply viewing them as failures. And for this, Rob Hinchey, one of the co-authors, had this great sort of entree to another world, environmental engineers learning from geotechnical engineers, which is a scary thought, but they do have this great sort of concept called the observational approach that we've borrowed and put in here. So we're on to slide 74 here, and the observational approach comes out of geotechnical engineering, and it comes out of Terzaghi and others having to live with uncertainty in design of subsurface engineering projects. And it's the same problem that we're faced with. So the number one, they say, assess the probable conditions and develop contingency plans for the plausible variations. So we're going to say, well, we think it's X, but we realize Y could also happen, and let's at least be cognizant of the plausible variations. The second is to establish parameters for observation. That's where the word observational comes from, and look for those plausible variations, and be ready to deal with them.
These are these functional objectives in the NRC
window. Right. For example, your remedy didn't achieve an order of magnitude improvement in downgrading water quality, the time frame you hoped for. But to know that, you have to be making observations. So a critical part of a remedy is having a plan, and having a plan, a contingency plan, too. So the third bullet, measure parameters and compare to predicted values, this needs to be an ongoing process. Is it working? How are we doing? Are we on track? You know, do we need to consider other alternatives? And the last thing is this: change the design as needed. I think we need to be flexible enough to add additional attributes to the design if it's not working as well as we had hoped. And we can plan for these things in advance in many instances.
So the last FAQ is, where can I find more information? And I think, as we said before, that the FAQ is supposed to be this entree where there's a lot of references you can go through there. A lot of these things are hardwired in the CLUIN web page that you can go to these different places. But we just wanted to bring your attention. It's really this place where you can go see some of this great research that's out there. So that's slide 75. Slide 76, what's the iceberg about?
The iceberg, I was thinking about this for an Army presentation I gave a few weeks ago. I was thinking that it's as though we've been standing on top of an iceberg with an axe, knocking off pieces of ice. And so you knock off a piece of ice on the top of this iceberg, and what happens? The iceberg just floats up higher. And we become frustrated. We're knocking all this ice off, and we still have an iceberg, you know. Why isn't it going away? And the reason it's not going away is our perception of the problem is limited to what we easily see, which is the contaminants in the aqueous phase in transmissive zones, and maybe Dean apple, particularly if we have Dean apple in a well. But all these other compartments have really been below the water. They've been out of our sight, and we haven't given them full attention. I guess the point of this all is if we appreciate all the compartments we need to deal with, and including that which we can't readily see, we'll be far more successful. And I guess returning to a theme, there's hope in that. We now know it's not just about the ice that's sticking out of the water, but it's about the ice that's under the water too.
So the message, it's not a pessimistic message, it's just new information, and we can adapt to this and come up with good solutions that match what's going on at sites. In some cases that's remediation, in some cases something else, but this new information will help us make better decisions.
And it's all concisely presented, not all. A lot of really good information is presented in the FAQs, and we've been getting all kinds of wonderful feedback. One of my favorite was somebody said he read the whole thing, and then he turned it over and reread it again.
I like it.
So it's accessible, and hopefully many of you will take a look at it and share it with your friends.
I think there's just two slides left. We have discussion, and I'm not sure how this happened. It certainly wasn't intentional, but we are at 1 hour and 45 minutes, so we have roughly 15 minutes for questions. Certainly not by design on our part, but I think we're at the end, and maybe just show the last slide.
Yeah.
And then I think we're done.
I think we'll pass it back to Andrea and let her moderate.
Sounds great.
I have received one question online. Can you elaborate or give an example of managing risk as a functional objective?
Sure. Let's say there's an off-site plume, and it's creating a vapor hazard in homes. And you want to reduce the concentrations in soil gas such that the homes aren't threatened. So your functional objective
is to do something about that dissolved plume that's underneath that house.
Is to get to a concentration in soil gas that's protective of residents. And
So perhaps you're going to say, well, I'm going to cut off the source by digging up the source. I'm going to cut off the flux from the source by digging up the source. It's kind of a brute force example. That's going to give me an order of magnitude improvement in groundwater quality down gradient, and consequently, I would hope in a reasonable period of time, an improvement in soil gas concentration. So you could proceed with that as your premise, and then as a contingency plan, you're going to monitor to see if that actually happens. And a secondary plan, you might think of a more robust action in the neighborhood.
And the other, or more commonly, you might say, I've got this risk in a house, and I'm sure it's from this plume, and I have to manage that risk, so I'm going to put some sort of venting system in the house.
Right.
And that's going to basically take care of that vapor problem.
Or interrupt that pathway directly and instantaneously. That's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
This is Andrea again. That's all the questions we have online. Let me give a couple of minutes here if anyone on the phone would like to ask some questions.
You know, maybe while that's going on, I'll just, Chuck and I have to acknowledge Hans Stroh and Rob Hinchy and Paul Johnson. They've been with us all the way on these documents and helping out, and we don't in any way mean to undermine their or diminish their contribution. And also Andrea, ESTCP CERT, of course.
Are you going
to think? Okay. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Are you two folks seeing any evidence of partitioning of vapors back into soil or aqueous or groundwater phase?
Well, I think Mendoza did these papers a long time ago, mid-1990s from Waterloo, where vapors, where they measured vapors coming from a plume and then making like a 5-part per billion plume down gradient. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, a setting where you might, if you had a large vadose zone, say some of these basin fill sediments in California, where you maybe have hundreds of feet, the DNAP will probably never, in some of these instances, never reach the water table. That you will find contamination, relatively low levels, in groundwater. So I think in instances where you have large vadose zones, it's possible to have vapor transport be the source. Now, one way you can often tell is to try to profile concentrations across that, and if they decline rapidly into the water phase, that's often indicative that you have a vapor phase source.
But I think the main message is that, and maybe I'm wrong here, that's relatively rare. In that, in most cases, the partitioning is going the other way, that you do have a dissolved phase plume and a transmissive zone, and that material is partitioning into the vapor in the unsaturated zone. So it's more common to go the other way and then form these indoor air problems.
It's kind of a function of where you're hanging out hydrogeologically. If you're out here in the west where it's arid and there's large vadose zones, it's more frequent than back east where more typically the groundwater levels are higher. Good question.
Yes, I have a question. What kind of concentration of chlorinated compounds would you assume to still have a DNAP source? Would it be like less than 1,000 ppm or greater than 1,000 ppm?
So that sort of goes into some of the original work that was done a long time ago. John Cherry came up with, and the folks at Waterloo, this 1% rule was indicative of DNAP. That was in an EPA document that I talked about. And for better or for worse, that rule is still being used. It's very crude, and you can have sites that have higher concentrations than 1% solubility that show DNAP sites that are going to have less. In terms of, I think your question is that what's the absolute concentration, I guess, that where you would start thinking you have DNAP? I think it's hard to tell. You could have some highly charged, low permeability compartments that are diffusing out, and you're not sure if that's DNAP or not. And I think the Colorado School of Mines project showed that. And
yeah.
So it's something that's very difficult to ascertain.
I add a couple things to that. The danger of the 1% or even 10% rule is people have found in plumes taking point measurements, concentrations as high as 10% of solubility, 100 meters away from the release.
That's a down gradient.
Down gradient. So that concentrational, and you know you don't have DNAP there, so it's a bit tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go back to the source, if you have DNAP in wells, that's really, or you can see it in soil cores, stuff like that, that really tells you it's there. But whether it's Dean Apple, if you have Dean Apple, you also have these other sources, and I think you need to manage them together and holistically. You need to start filling in the 14-point part. I don't know how rigorously important it is. It's probably a site-specific thing, whether you have Dean Apple or not, in the source zone. You're going to have to find a holistic solution for all the compartments and not just that one. Maybe that's the point I want to make. I'll make one more point. The back diffusion signals, by the nature of the physics, are always going to be weaker than the original signals. They're always going to be weaker. Now, how much weaker?
Order of magnitude?
It changes with time. Yeah. You know, right after, like in that tank experiment, right after the release, it's almost the same. And if you wait 20 years, it's going to be orders of magnitude lower.
Mm-hmm. And so the day after the Dean Apple dissolves, it
may not look any
different. But then it is going to tail away with this tail.
Yep.
It's somewhat of an exponential decay. It just persists for a long time.
I guess the key thought is don't just think about Dean Apple as though it's the sole problem.
I have a question on the clarification on slide 10 where you indicated there is a minimal vapor plume off of late stage Apple source areas.
Slide 10 is the cartoon.
I tried to say this before. These are hypothetical distributions. It doesn't mean that all are going to look like this. It's really kind of site-specific. So as we're using in this decision guide, we're offering up template conditions, but we're saying really think about your site specifically. So it may or may not be there, depending upon your specific site conditions.
So let's look at slide 10 and see what we've got here. So your question is about the vapor plume that we've got, and it looks like it's not connected to the groundwater plume. Is that part of your question?
It is. It's, I guess, the differentiation you had between the mid and the late stage on the conceptual site model was that the vapor plume should be either greatly diminished or absent on a late stage, and yet it's still shown on the late stage CSM kind of cartoon model there. So I just wanted to clarify if that was really the case, or would we still have a vapor plume associated with late stage Apple source areas?
I think it's plausible to have a vapor plume associated with late stage conditions, and I say that based on some late stage sites that have vapor plumes.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it doesn't mean all of them, but I think it is plausible that you can have them still.
But I think our drawing is that it meets our it sort of shows what we were thinking about is that there's this thin blue line right at the water table, both middle and late. It gets thinner at late, but you still have a groundwater plume right at the water table that is partitioning into the vagozone, making this vapor plume. And so the plume may be weaker, maybe the vapor plume is weaker, but it's still there. And it's because you have a dissolved plume, and the reason you have a dissolved plume is because the low permeability zones are still acting as sources. That's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Something we struggle with is whenever we make generalizations, we always exceptions. So everything we put out, you need to think about your unique conditions and attributes. All sites have peculiarities.
Hey, Chuck and Tom, Andrea again. I had a question for you from online. I have a site that is using containment with groundwater monitoring as a long-term remedy for a chlorinated solvent site. The MCLs are close to being met for the downgradient wells. It seems that groundwater contamination is stable. When can groundwater monitoring end at the site if the contamination is stable within the containment area and is not moving off-site?
And I think the answer is that sort of depends on the stakeholders, and it also depends what regulatory regime you have. For example, the Texas Risk Reduction Program has got regulations that say in the regulations that if you do get a stable plume and you demonstrate this for that it is stable, that at some point you can stop the monitoring, and you basically go to that late stage. In practice, I think that's rarely done because I think regulators want to keep watching that thing and make sure that something doesn't happen to it. So I guess what a related question is, how often do you have a big change of conditions where you have a stable plume and all of a sudden starts growing again? And I don't think I've ever seen that. I'm not saying it's impossible, but maybe that's a gave you a sort of regulatory answer than a technical answer, and it maybe the thing is, I don't know, or it depends.
You know, whether you'd want to end monitoring, too, it would have a function of, if there was a water supply well immediately down gradient, that would be one scenario, and if you were flowing underneath some salt playa out in the middle of a desert somewhere, that would be a different scenario.
Or a runway or something like
that. Right, or runway. So I think there's a lot of
unique attributes of individual sites that would dictate whether ending monitoring would be prudent. Also, the certainty of the containment. Some containment systems are better than others. They're not all created equal.
There's a lot of work being done on ways that you can monitor this thing, but make it a lot cheaper. And for example, this MAROS program that we developed for the Air Force helps people look at the staff and maybe at that stage, maybe you don't need quarterly sampling. Maybe you get away with sampling every other year. And then there's we're working on a sort of project now to come up with new ways to basically monitor the groundwater concentrations without sending samples to the lab. And so that's just some other, people are working on that, sort of the ESTs are working on that. It's sort of this middle ground where you keep monitoring it, but at a very low intensity, very economical way.
Some of these sites are now going into their second 5-year review. And some of these sites have proven themselves reliable containment sites over decades now. And people are beginning to contemplate perhaps we only need to monitor right in advance of the 5-year review every 5 years. So there's a lot of site specificity. Now that wouldn't be appropriate at all sites, but maybe it's appropriate some.
And just one last thought, I'm sort of just going on here, is that your question was about stable plumes. I think some of these coordinated solvent plumes are shrinking, you know, perhaps not a big percent of them, but they're shrinking. And in that case, I think there's a better case for saying that source for whatever is on that downward trend, and I can sort of, if as long as I don't have that daycare center drinking water down gradient, perhaps that's one I could stop monitoring.
I had a clarification on slide 17. You'd indicated that the relative value of, I guess, monitoring wells was a poor indicator of the overall availability of the NAPL there. Would that value change with the more high resolution mass flux, or would it still be about that same value?
Well, if you get high resolution mass flux, that would tell you, I think you would be better informed about what's in all these compartments. So with that, you would get a higher score. The point of this was just to say that 10-foot well screens, or the conventional monitoring well, is not a very sharp instrument. If you're proposing something more rigorous, then it's certainly going to leave you better informed. And I think that's a great thing to contemplate. You know, one thing about we didn't really get into this, the 14-compartment model. We pretended that we know what's in these compartments. But if you don't know, maybe you should find out. And maybe you should employ the tools that are needed to find out what's in the compartments that are of greatest relevance to you.
And so Beth Parker at Guelph has developed this method of sampling these low permeability zones and figuring out what's in there to help you figure out this back diffusion process. We're real interested the group here at using MIPS, perhaps going through these low permeability zones, and perhaps that could be a way you could figure out the mass in there.
Yeah, so one thing about the 14 compartment, it informs you not only about, well, it's a basis to design your site organization. And if you, for example, if you think you're in a sandy aquifer that's late stage, look at the compartments that potentially could be your problems, and perhaps you want to go out and find out more about those. A late stage site, I'd say definitely want to think about at least low permeability zones. So it's interesting how it informs you that question.
Hello, my name is Jack Arias from Rich and Six. I have a question. It's related more with the analysis of the soil and the identification of all the different microorganisms in the soil too. So just looking at your results, I can see there is a natural attenuation through time. So now I was wondering, in your experiments in the lab, did you did a soil analysis and identification of the probably bacteria or fungal microorganisms? And well, in the lab you have control conditions. And what happened when you go to the field? What do you do? Do you do an analysis of the soil too and identification of these microorganisms? And at the same time too, do you know the conditions actually is going to change, you know, according, you know, to the place where you're going, you know, where you have the contamination and the plume. Always the conditions are going to change, pH, porosity, which the porosity will depend on the kind of soil that you have. So how do you deal with that? How do you identify where you have the spill or maybe the chlorinated compounds going, and is the soil is like a sandy soil or it's a combination of clay and sandy soil?
Right. Tom, you want to take this?
Let's take the lab part first. I would presume that
our lab soils, there was no biological processes going on. The sand tanks ran for relatively short periods of time, and the site that the soils came from, there was little evidence of any active biodegradation going on. It was a highly aerobic site. Now, moving to the field, I don't think we, particularly when it comes to low permeability zones, understand what's going on in them biogeochemically. I mean, it's an odd combination of processes in a space that we really haven't looked very carefully. Now, Beth Parker goes in and collects continuous core, and she very carefully extracts the contaminants. And we're just on the horizon now in line of research is looking at the microbiological communities and the biogeochemical conditions in those areas. So CERTA just put out a call for research on managing contaminants in low permeability zones, and there'll be a bunch of interesting research on that in the coming years.
But just stepping back in terms of an entire site and looking at things, there are groups or there are techniques where you can take soil samples, you ship them to a lab, and they'll tell you if you've got these key dechlorinators in there, the Helicocoides and these guys. And so that's done at some sites for monitored natural attenuation. However, at other sites, you just know what's happening. If it's a TCE site and you have cis-DCE, that's this indicator those bugs are there because that's the biological breakdown product. So thinking about what's happening is you can use geochemistry and you can use the presence of daughter products to sort of figure out if that biodegradation is occurring. And if you want, you can go that extra step and look for the bugs.
Yeah, and ultimately, once we know the answer to that question, we'll be able to go one step further and say, what can we do to encourage it?
Yeah. So the current thought is the bugs are too big to fit into clays, and we're going to see if that turns out to be true or not in terms of the next couple of years of research. But definitely they can fit in silts and sands, and those are low permeability zones. And then in situation in the clays and these things, you can have this degradation based on iron. It's relatively slow rates. John Wilson is doing a lot of research on that from EPA. So there is attenuation in those low permeability zones, but we don't really have a handle on sort of the complete picture of what's happening yet.
Beth Parker is at the forefront of this. She has data sets from tens of sites, and at some of them she's seeing evidence of degradation going on in low permeability zones, and some she isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And why and when and where it needs to be worked on.
Well,
okay.
I think, I have another question. I think it's very important for you and your experiments or studies, even in the field, that you have to do a soil analysis. Because, it's like you mentioned that you're showing your results about, you were talking about iron and carbon, compounds.
Right.
You know what happens if the soil actually has high concentration of iron already,
Yep.
Or maybe other, inorganic compounds that actually will bind, or maybe bind the chlorinate compounds. And at the same time, too, like bacteria, I saw in one of your slides, you were saying one of the techniques that you do is like putting mulch. And after that, what you do, you put water. So actually, when you put mulch and you mix it with the soil, actually, what you're going to get over there is mainly it's going to be bacteria and it's going to be the fungal microorganisms. So, and I know that there's a lot of articles that they already did, identification of a specific, fungal microorganisms and even bacteria that actually they mineralize, the organic compounds. In this case, it will be chlorinated compounds. So I guess that's really important because I see in other articles too, there were errors because they didn't even at the lab level, they didn't do analysis of the soil and they didn't, actually realize that probably the soil have some compounds that they were actually causing some errors, in the results. Actually, it wasn't only, the porosity or maybe of the flow, of the plume, in the experiment. It was because the composition of the soil too, including, microorganisms too.
Yeah, so the biodegradation is a key pathway, and it's something that's very important, and the bacteria are important. My company's put in some mulch walls, and that stuff can really go anaerobic and really get you a lot of degradation. So there's a lot of processes out there that you've got to understand and focus if you want to really understand your site.
Yeah, because another thing too, like what I see, about, you were talking about retardation factor. If you mix, sand and clay, and you use the sand and clay mix, in your barriers, if you see the plume coming, actually you're going to increase the retardation factor. If you have bacteria or fungal microorganisms over there, so they actually, and because this is aerobic, actually these bacteria and fungal microorganisms, they are going to actually, they are aerobic. So if the medium is aerobic, actually, it's going to produce more of this population over there. And plus, the retardation factor is less. So actually, they are going to, you know, disintegrate, you know, all the organic compounds in a better way. And this is what I'm looking at in your results. Through time, actually, they are going, it's like a filter, you know, to the soil. Okay, there's not mainly the soil, it's because there's different organic compounds and different microorganisms, actually, they're doing the work.
This is Andrea Lease, and I'm afraid we're going to have to move on. We're 5 minutes past when we were supposed to end, and the EPA has another session starting soon.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to say, if you do have additional questions, our contact information is on the website, and you can access our email addresses there. I did want to thank everyone for attending the seminar today. Just as a reminder, under the links to additional resources, you will find a link to the FAQ document itself upon which the seminar was based. You'll also find the video that was mentioned during the seminar and several relevant links for various information either about CERTIP and ESTCP or about documents that are discussed in the FAQs. Also, just a reminder, the audio and the presentation itself will be archived for future reference. Again, thanks very much for participating, and goodbye.
Bye.